accession number 19777, Reel 2.
Bill Norman, Reel 2.
I said I met up with Armitage, and he got hit in the thigh and said, leave me, go down and find Abramson. So I went down there, and he was lying there, shot through the head. He was obviously dead. And I was looking around, wondering what to do. And I got shot out, so I thought, well, damn this, I'm not staying here. And I went back up, and all the fellas were moving in a different direction. So I never really went to see how many Japs had been shot, and if any of them were any I shot at. I reckon if any I shot at were in a bad position, because there's one of the battalion rifle shots. There I met I saw a dead Indian with a Bren gun, so I grabbed this Bren gun. I didn't even know how to load the damn thing. Although I had a good idea, because we had a similar Vickers Berthier gun in the Indian Army. I got two or three magazines, don't remember, and somebody showed me how to put them on, and the rest I knew how to cock it and work it. And I handed my rifle over to our rangefinder, who was only equipped with a revolver, Jackie Waterhouse, and he was very pleased to get that. And we set off marching towards the Sitang. And we marched and we marched, and we were thirsty. We were absolutely going mad for water, crazy. One fella dropped out, and we had a sergeant who was the band sergeant, Yarnold, Ginger Yarnold. And he was a right B. And he went up to this fella and he says, get up. And this bloke moaned. And he kicked him. He said, come on, get on your feet and march. And I thought, well, you callous person. Or words to that effect. And he looked him in the face. He says, do you want to die? He says, I want to go home. I want to go home. And he was a fellow that had only just recently joined the battalion from England. But he obviously, he was absolutely done. And he said, right, leave him. So we left him, thinking that somebody would pick him up. It'd be an ambulance or something. But he was never heard of again. And I noticed he's on the casualty, so he's being killed in action. Eventually we came to some water. And there was an absolute mad rush for it. Everybody dived this dirty, muddy, stinking water, drinking it and pouring it over their heads. Nothing could have stopped them. They said later that there was a dead mule in it. I didn't see it, but if I had done, it wouldn't have made any difference. Now, we got ourselves organised, and we started picketing the hills, something we were good at, coming from the northwest frontier. It came under no fire. We just went up there and to sort of protect the road while everybody got through. At one time, we saw a load of people marching towards across the paddy fields, probably 400 or 500 yards away. And the sergeant ordered me to open fire on them. And I said, no, they're ours. And he said, fire on them. And he was a bit crazy himself. I thought, he's not right in the head. And I said, no, I'm not going to fire on them. He said, I'll court-martial you. And all the rest of the chaps sort of jeered him. And he realised he was in the wrong. And I reckon he had a premonition, this fella, because he was killed the same day. The Japs were there somewhere, because we found quite a lot of their empty cartridge cases, which I noted were quite smaller than ours. I think 6.5 millimetre. We came down and we went to some place, I believe it was Mokpalin, and we took up positions in the paddy fields. But now we were covered in sweat, our clothes were wet, we were dying of thirst, we were hungry, but we didn't think much about that. All we wanted was water, and we laid down in position. And during the night, we had the panic fire like the Burmese had had. Somebody would see something, or think they did, and fire a shot. Then somebody else would open up. Then someone else, and in no time, all the platoon was firing at nothing. And us being NCOs, we tried to calm them down, which we eventually did. It seemed to me that this was a thing that happened to all units, where until they learn and get a bit of experience about what to shoot at and what not. The Japanese were there. They called out to us and they were shouting to us, shouting, "All NCOs come this way." And they were shouting out to the King's Own Yorkshire Light Infantry, "All coilies, come along." But we now learned to keep quiet. Daylight came. And one thing I must say, in the night it was freezing cold, because we were wet and the nights got very cold in Burma at that part time of the year. Sergeant Jan said, "Look, go out there about 500 yards forward and cover that hill." I didn't see any point in it, but I went. And I laid down there behind a paddy bund, which was about 6 inches high, with this Bren gun and my three magazines, I think it was. And nothing happened. And I was lying in the sun, still no water. And suddenly a machine gun fired at me. I got my head down and I kept it down, and I heard a voice, Yarmul, who we were all terrified of, "Can you see him?" And without looking, I said, "No." So I thought, well, you didn't even damn well look. So I put my head up and down quick and said, "No, I can't see him, Sergeant." I thought, well, that's not very good. Take a proper look. So I stuck my tin hat over the top. Nothing happened. So I looked over. And I was looking around. Now I got a bit brave. Nothing at all. And I was searching. And then there was another burst of fire. And this time it was closer. And bits of sand was in my face. And I thought, to hell with this, and kept my head down and I went to sleep. I was exhausted, really. Next thing I knew was the officer was stood there, my platoon commander. And he says, "Do you want something to eat?" I said, "Don't stand there, so you'll get shot." And he said, "Oh, I've got all sorts of things." And I thought, he's not right, this fella. I think he was... Like many others, you know, they were so been so much in the sun and exhausted, their minds were wandering a bit. And I said, "No, all I want is some water." But he gave me a biscuit, and I ate it, and I hadn't enough saliva, and it fell out of my mouth. I was very pleased when Yarnell called me back, and he said, "Right, we're going to withdraw. Oh, by the way, there was quite a bit of shelling and mortaring going on all the time, but nothing coming our way." And he said, "We're going to withdraw." He said, "And I want you to hold this position till I get back with Smith and Longdon." "Right, Sergeant." He said, "Now I'll give you orders when to withdraw." "Yes, Sergeant." Then a plane came over. And everybody in the division shot at it. And we shot it down. And everybody in the division claimed it too. So I laid in this position. And nothing was happening. And time went by. And there was just nobody there except us. I looked up at there. And I could see all our divisional transport had been parked in one place because it couldn't cross the bridge, which kept falling into the hands of the Japs, or so we thought. And then back to us, and there was fighting going on like hell up there. But we were all right, there was nothing happening. And I saw Japanese marching behind the railway line, which was built up on an embankment, and where the bridge was, there were just pillars, and I could see them marching in between. But they were about 500 or 600 yards away, and I wasn't going to waste my ammunition on them. By now, Smith, 83, with two Smiths, Smith 80 and 83, he was beginning to get a little bit moaning, a bit fed up, and he was moaning, and they were saying, "They've left us here." He said, "I think we ought to withdraw," and I said, "You'll damn well stay here with me." And I was afraid if I withdrew, I'd bump into the platoon, and they'd say, "What have you withdrawn for? Who gave you permission to leave your position?" And I was more scared of that than the Japs, but it was a very lonely place. So I sent Smith. I said, "Look, go back and find the platoon. And when you do, tell them that I'm going to withdraw at 1 o'clock. And that was about 3/4 of an hour. I said, "If you can't get back, don't bother. I'll withdraw at 1 o'clock. So off he went. And then along came some of our carrier platoon with their brain guns under Captain Christensen. And Captain Christensen was the son of General Christensen, who'd been our colonel. And he was there not very long. And I said, "Look, sir," I said, "I've been left here." I said, "What do I do?" I said, "I know, no." He says, you obey your orders," or words to that effect. He says, "But I'm leaving here, and I would advise you to do the same." So off they went. So there was only me and Jack Longdon left there. And I thought, well, I better wait till 1 o'clock. But now we were coming under fire, and I saw quite a lot of Japs under this bridge. So I gave them a couple of bursts. I don't know whether it hit them, but they moved away. That would be quite a long range, actually, 500 or 600 yards. And Jack and I went back. And to our amazement, we came to the river. The River Sitang. And I thought, God, what a wide river. It was about a mile across. And there was nobody there, not a soul. We were absolutely on our own. And I thought, well, what are we going to do? I said, "Well, we better cross that, Jack. It's either that or surrender into the Japs, and I'm not going to do that." And he says, "Right." And he disappeared. I thought, well, I wonder if he won't have left me. What's he doing? And along came another fella from the band, just appeared from nowhere, and he says, "Oh," he says, "I tried to get across that river, and I got halfway and swam back." He says, "I'm not a good swimmer, what shall I do?" I says, "You bloody fool." I said, "Why didn't you keep going?" I said, "Well, get up there to the river, to the bridge." And I could see that this bridge had been blown up, there were two spans hanging in the water. I forgot to mention that during the night, there'd been a tremendous explosion, but I never heard it. I was asleep at that time, and everyone said the bridge had been blown up and we were cut off over this river, which we were. The division lost at least half of its strength or more. Poor old general had to blow the bridge and leave most of his troops on the wrong side of it. However, we got to the River Sitang, and suddenly Jack appeared again with a bamboo pole, and he says, "We'll have some support to get across there." So I stripped the Bren, I threw it in the water, stripped down to my shorts, and we got off and we set off swimming. And we swam and we swam and it just seemed to go on. I had no idea how long. A bit of machine gun fire came our way, but whoever it was fired at us, they stopped. And it was fired from a long distance. I think the Japs must have thought they'd got us. And as we were swimming, there was somebody following us. And this bamboo pole was getting waterlogged, and one could rest on it, but not two. If two rested on it, then it would sink. And this fellow was swimming along, and he came near, and I said, "If you're wanting a lift to rest on this pole," I said, "you can't." I said, "Because it'll only hold one." He said, "Oh, no." He says, "I'm a good swimmer." He said, "I'm Anglo-Burmese from the auxiliary artillery battery." He says, "And I'm 6'4", and I can swim these rivers easy. I'm used to it." And by now, we were both getting exhausted, and we'd rest on this, and we'd both go under the water, and I thought, "God, something's going to happen here soon." And this Burmese fella came along, got his shoulder under it, and supported it, and helped us. Eventually, he swam ahead, and he said, "I can touch the bottom now." And he could, and we got up with him. We were damn pleased to reach the other side. How long I'd been in the water, I have no idea. I got there expecting to see all troops lined up, and artillery and trenches, but there were not a soul. Eventually, we saw a Burmese soldier with a Tommy gun, and he waved and told us to go to a place called War. W-A-W, War. Very appropriately named. And this Burmese fella, this Anglo-Burmese chap, says, "Don't trust them. We'll go to Rangoon. I live there, and I know it." So I thought, right, that's the best thing. And we hadn't gone far when a chap called Donkersley caught up with us. And he had with him a dogra. And he said, "This bloke's followed me all day like a little dog." And they weren't equipped. They had no arms, with no arms at all. We'd lost them all in the river. And so we just started walking, but the ground was very, very hard and it was hot. It was like walking on an oven top. Eventually we came to a village, and the village is all turned out with dars and lined up and shouted at us. And I thought, God, they're going to attack. They'd be about 150 yards away. And nearby were some bamboo poles that had been sharpened. Obviously, they're going to knock them in the ground. So I grabbed these and I said, "Right, line up. Get at the high port. When I say charge, we'll charge straight through them, scatter them." But this Burmese fella ran ahead. And then he waved us and he says, "It's all right, come on, I speak the language." I say Burmese, I mean Anglo-Burmese. And he said, they're very sorry, but they thought we were escaped convicts. And I thought, what a yarn. But they were very kind to us, and they gave us rice to eat, they gave us water, and they told us to cover our bodies in mud so that we wouldn't get hurt by the sun, and to wear these hats. And they gave us a little conical coolie hats made of bamboo. He said, and if a Japanese plane comes, wave to it, and then they will think you are Burmese. So we thought this was a good idea, and they gave us a guide to the next village. I've since thought that these people were frightened and they were telling the truth, because there was a penal settlement nearby, and they'd let all the convicts out, and they were terrorising the area. And our Colonel Owen had been murdered by somebody, and I think it was these people, these escaped convicts, that had done it. And I wonder if it was the same village that he was killed in. And they were frightened that we would blame them. Anyhow, they couldn't help us, and they couldn't do enough for us, and they took us to another village, and they were the same, and they took us to another one and gave us a guide. One village we came to, the people were different. There was somebody stirring them up, and they all crowded round us. And to be in an Oriental village surrounded by people was a frightening experience. They were hostile. And I said, come on, let's get out of here. Just work your way out. And I said, tell these people that we have got lost and we swam across the river and we're looking for the rest of our soldiers. So he did do. I said, and tell them that there's a lot more soldiers come across here from England, and they're in tanks. And describe a tank to them. They did do. I thought, I'll try and frighten them. And tell them that if they return us to them, they will get rewarded. And they all looked and they calmed down a bit. And I feared that, you know, I only wanted one to say go, and they would have attacked us and tore us apart. And a lot of them were armed too with dars, which is like a mache. And these people, these Burmese, they said, oh yes, we have seen these soldiers, and we have seen these chain garries, they call them. A garry is a cart, a car. And that surprised me. Chain garries, they said, yes, they don't go on wheels, they go on, and they described tracks towards him. Well, what it was the 7th Armoured Brigade had come from the Middle East and landed, and now there was these people had seen them, and they were describing them to us. So we got to a road, and they followed us. Some of them followed us, and we kept walking and walking. And I said, don't run, for goodness sake. If they see us run, they'll think we're running away. Just keep walking and wave to them now and again. And we did do. And we kept going. And eventually they dropped off. And then it was getting dark. We ran towards war. And eventually we saw some soldiers making tea. And we were damn pleased to see them. And they were RASC. And I was rather surprised to see them, because the RASC, the Royal Army Service Corps, they didn't have them in India. They were all Indian Army Service Corps. And they told us that they were part of the 7th Armoured Brigade. I didn't know who they were, and I had no idea who the 7th Armoured Brigade were. And eventually, I did forget to tell you, the first man we met was a brigadier. Not these people. And he said, "Who are you? Why aren't you dressed? Why are you like this?" And he put us under arrest. And these service corps people had to look after us. And I said to this, I asked them who they were, and they told us. And they had a very nasty attitude towards us. And I said, "Can we have a drink of tea?" And they said, "No, you can't." Which is not the way you treat soldiers. I thought, what's up with these people? And then the military police came along. And they said, "Come on, get in this truck." I said, "Well, what's the matter? What are we under arrest for?" And they said, "Oh, no, you're not. We found your regiment." He said, "The brigadier put you under arrest because he thought you was deserters." He said, "But we found out now what's happened." And it dawned on me then that these people just had no idea that the army had been just about destroyed at the Sitang Bridge. And we were all coming along straggling. We spent the night in the village, and the next day we got back to the battalion and we were reorganised. We went to PDU, where they amalgamated the Dukes, that's the Duke of Wellington's, with the Coilies, which is the King's Own Yorkshire Light Infantry. The casualty being so heavy that we couldn't work anymore as our independent regiments, and they decided that they'd just make one out of us. That was a wrong decision. We did not like the Coilies, and the Coilies did not like us. And in no way were we going to cooperate with them and them with us. So after 2 days, that idea was abandoned. I was put in a truck and sent to divisional headquarters. And to my horror, I'd found I'd been transferred to the military police. I promptly went to the captain. I said, "Look, sir, I don't want to be in the military police. I'm in the Duke of Wellington's regiment. I want to go back there." He told me, "You'll go where I tell you." I thought, well, I'm going to get out of this somehow. So I thought, well, I like dumb. And the first thing I was told, go round the brigade and take the names of anyone that's got fires. People were lighting fires and giving their positions away. So I went round, and the first people I met were some Gurkhas. And they were making tea, and I said, "Hey, Johnny, kuchnay fire." And they said, "Cha sab, tea." And I said, "Oh, go on then." So I sat and had tea, and then I went back and told the staff sergeant. He said,